During the 58-70 period, we added some good staff members, and we lost a few, not very many. Alf Harper, we lost to MIT, but we got him back, so that was fine. He's been he, of course, was very important to campus in terms of getting the nutritional sciences group going and chairing it for a good many years. The
He was. He sort of had to do that, didn't he, because of the problems in home economics? Wasn't that a question of the dean's asking him to?
Well, things, of course, I mean, home economics was always a part of the College of Agriculture, and there'd been a rather distinguished program up there, and there often had been close collaboration with people in biochemistry. Steenbach had worked some with them. Connie Elvin had worked quite extensively with the people up in Homec. They'd had some very good nutritionists up in Homec.
Well, I meant, with, there was a problem with Marshall, was it the director?
Yeah, well, then they see the Homec decided, well, they sort of thought they should have more independence. It was a great mistake because their strength came from their association with the college. And when they became independent, they acquired some administrators up there who really were not particularly good. And the strong people from up there, like Dorothy Cushman Strong, migrated over to food science, food and dairy science.
Well, anyway,
and the people that sort of, you know, they became, the highly competent ones became sort of isolated over there. And so nutritional science from a strong position dropped to a relatively weak position, and so Alf was recruited to try to build the thing up. So he had to start from a relatively weak base, actually, so it was difficult. But I just don't think they recognized that their strength lay with their associations and the rest of the College of Agriculture, and that independence was really the wrong thing in terms of their own development. But anyway, Alf, of course, was active. Harper was active down here in biochemistry also, and so we had a pretty good show during that period, and
so when does
it was an interesting era.
When does molecular biology begin to raise its head?
I don't remember. Molecular biology came in the early 60s, as a matter of fact. It was about 62 or thereabouts that this started. And one of the things that triggered it was the obvious developments in molecular biology. Some exciting things were starting to happen.
1961 met informally to discuss the future of molecular biology in campus.
Okay, 61 then. So it was when I was chairman, and for some time at least I chaired the committee that was involved in this development. And a good bit of the discussion centered around a institute that would help to keep Harlan Halverson on campus, and also fellow over in genetics, had his name at my tongue a while ago.
Was he on the committee? Because there is people like Beeman or
Ernst Fries was in genetics at that time, and he was had some kind of an offer, and Harlan Halverson also had an attractive offer, and so they were talking about leaving the campus, and they're both doing very good work, and so people wanted to keep them, and they thought that if there were a molecular biology institute where they could follow some of the new areas and develop it, that they might have a freer hand than they had in bacteriology and in genetics to mold this sort of thing. So there was an active discussion about the possibilities of such an institute. There were serious questions raised about it by the existing departments. Any department is sort of jealous of its own turf, and so the biochemist's answer was, why have a molecular biologist? A molecular biologist is no different than a biochemist. scratch the skin and they're just the same underneath. It's just another name for biochemistry. And the bacteriologists, their approach was, all these fellows are working with microorganisms, just microbiology. Mm. The geneticists would say, well, you know, molecular biology is just modern genetics. It's part of the same show. I have an institute.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike, we discussed the thing, and it was brought to all these staffs, and in biochemistry, as I said, the reaction was not very enthusiastic, I'd say, but my feeling was, if there's a new development and these fellows can develop it, let them go ahead and do it. And there's always been good interaction on the campus. We ought to be able to, it should be advantageous to us to have a group like this on campus that can exploit the modern techniques and take a new look at things. And so I was, as chairman, was pretty supportive of it. And I suppose was attempted to be fairly persuasive about the issue. And so biochemistry approved it, and the other departments did more or less. Then we had to find a site for it.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned that the when we were talking about zoology and building and such, that they had rejected a site out here on the Ag campus. But in this particular case, although it was to be organized under the graduate school,
that was a big issue,
yes,
whether
right.
it would be or not.
That's right. The people were willing to come out to the College of Agriculture. They recognized that a site which was between bacteriology, biochemistry, genetics, and plant pathology was an ideal site for this sort of a development.
Well, they were all ag people anyway, weren't they? I mean, Halverson.
Well, Halverson was, and Friis was in genetics, but the people from other departments were in on the discussion.
Mm.
Perhaps my greatest persuasive feat was to go to the College of Agriculture faculty and persuade them they should give up their parking lot for the molecular biology development.
Hmm.
And because many of the people parked right down there, you see, was very close to Ag Hall. And so all the administrators, among others, parked down in that lot. It was a very convenient lot. So anyway, we got it through the College of Agriculture staff to release that area down there, and it was an ideal spot in terms of interactions with others in the biology community. So that was worked out, and then it was mostly, you mentioned in 61 it started, and then there was developments during 62, and I don't know just when they broke ground, but I guess it was going probably pretty well by 63 in terms of construction.
But you're not making much of the point. I mean, the College of Agriculture wanted it as a department, and you all decided it should be interdisciplinary.
The feeling was that the thing should be interdisciplinary.
Mm.
And as a result, the compromise that was worked out, and of course this was hashed over in all kinds of possibilities, I'm sure. I remember in great detail. But anyway, it was finally hashed out that this should be organized under the graduate school. Then it would be in no college, and it would cross campus lines, and there should be no barriers to embracing the program all over the campus. And it really has developed fairly well in that sense, that people in botany and zoology have people who not only are they're joint members from zoology, but they also have students who can take a degree in molecular biology while working over in the zoology department and such. So it has worked out reasonably well. Now the departments which are particularly active, been particularly active, are the five which share the so-called molecular biology training grant on campus now. That's bacteriology, biochemistry, genetics, physiological chemistry in the med school, and see, that's only four. There's a fifth one that's officially in it. I don't know. But anyway, there are five groups that share in the administration of this, of the molecular biology training grant.
Engineering doesn't have anything to do with it.
No, nobody from engineering. It's Physiological chem, genetics, Bhakti. I don't think it's plant path. No, it isn't plant path. In any case, there are... biophysics, that's the fourth. Oh. The fifth one is biophysics, mm-hmm. Sure. Molecular biology, biophysics, biochemistry, bacteriology, and physiological chemistry. Mm-hmm. So those five currently share the training grant. But the training grant is broader than that. People in agronomy, horticulture, plant pathology, botany, zoology have all had trainees in molecular biology and kids who've taken their degree over here. So mm-hmm. These five departments administer the grant, but the molecular biology training is more broadly based. Well, during this development in molecular biology, there'd been a lot of talk also about biophysics and the possibility of developing in biophysics. You talk to the physicists about this, and the physicists would say, there is no such thing as biophysics. And the biochemists would say, well, it's just a branch of biochemistry. And so it went. So it was the same sort of argument that you got in molecular biology. But biophysics was an emerging field. And biophysics had been confined to very few schools formerly before. There was a biophysics department at Columbia University. It was virtually all visual physiology was what biophysics was there. And these departments had been few and far between. But the discipline was emerging. And so the feeling was that if you're building a molecular biology, maybe we should get biophysics in on this too. And so biophysics, likewise, was organized along the same lines under the graduate school. And so when the building, by the time they were ready to build the building, there were these two groups mm-hmm. that were going to share the facility. And biophysics has had joint appointees with physics, biochemistry, and I guess genetics. So these things developed along in parallel. And the arguments about them were very similar.
You, when you were talking about this earlier, you said you did it in order to keep Halvorsen here, and then he left. And Fries.
Ernst Fries
left
earlier, yeah.
Was this a big disappointment then?
Well, you know, everybody liked Harlan. He was a very productive guy, and he'd been very active on campus. Ernst was a little less prominent on campus. Ernst had been trained as a physicist. He was one of the people who had been trained in physics, and in that era went into biology. Mm-hmm. There were quite a lot of people, you know, physicists that moved over into molecular biology fairly early in the game mm-hmm. and contributed a lot, actually. And so Ernst didn't have quite the visibility of Harlan. So there was disappointment when Harlan left, but the show was going by that time. And at that time, you see, Nomura had become a part of the group. And so it was developing, mm-hmm. and you could live with it. If he'd left immediately, I'm sure there would have been a lot more disappointment.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was here during the formative years, and so I don't think there was that much trauma.
What did you think of Alberti? As dean, I mean, as graduate dean.
Well, I seem to be a nice guy around here. I didn't ever have any trouble with Alberti. As a matter of fact, I was on the search committee that chose both Alberti and Bob Bach.
Uh-huh.
Now, Alberti is a very good physical chemist.
Yes.
And he's a very affable guy, and I thought he did a good job in the grad school. Now, the people in the Enzyme Institute, of course, were much closer to the grad school because their existence already depended upon the grad school. They're under mm-hmm. the grad school administration. So they're very close to it. They're closer to it than the people in biochemistry. And the general policies for the Enzyme Institute have been set by a committee appointed from the graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, that was very clear that this was going to be an Enzyme Institute and they were going to recruit people who would bring new things in the area of enzymology. So they originally brought Dave Green, they got Henry Lardy over there, and they got Gobin Khurana, and subsequently Nomura went over there and all that sort of thing. Now with the years there's been some shift and some tugging and pulling about where the realignment should be, and the current feeling is it should move more toward molecular biological and more away from traditional enzymology. And so this doesn't set well with everyone. And I don't know just what the argument was against Alberti. I gather that Henry Lardy wasn't very enthusiastic about some of his pushing for certain directions over there.
I think, yes.
But I think over the whole thing that Alberti was did a good job in the grad school. Alberti was amazingly well informed about what was going on this campus. And he made it a point to do it. Alberti is a sort of a strange guy in a way. You know, very frequently you encounter a chemist or something, and they're pretty narrow people. And they hate like sin to admit they don't know something about it. Chemists are fairly well up in the peck order, you know.
Yeah.
And they hate to admit that they don't know anything about art or music or history or anything like that. And so they dissemble and cover up on these things. Not Bob Alberti. If he didn't know anything about art, he'd go down to the art department and he'd talk to him until he knew something about art. Mm. And likewise these other departments. Alberti was not a bit ashamed of it, but he was ignorant.
Mm, that's really an admirable quality.
That's a very unusual quality in administrators. Mm. But Alberti, if he didn't know, would proceed to become informed.
Mm.
And so I happen to serve, I guess, on it. I was in the grad administrative committee, and maybe it was out when Alberti was up there. But at least I had enough dealings with him to be quite impressed with the fact that the guy was willing to learn.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that the departments, such as I have mentioned, were very appreciative of this and a grad team. Because they've been living with scientists for a long time who really couldn't have cared less about the humanities and such.
Yes.
And when Alberti showed some compassion to their problems, they thought he was the greatest that had ever been up there.
Oh, I'm glad that's interesting.
So, I have nothing against Bob. I think that our loss was MIT's gain, but fortunately we got one of his students, namely Bob Bach, to take over, and Bach has really been, an outstanding dean.
I thought he was a fellow student of Alberti's, Williams.
I thought he was a student with Bob, I'm not certain about that, but anyway, they came out of the same general mold, and I think Bach's done very well. He also is amazingly well informed on a broad area. Mm. But and he's been at it for a good many years, and I was also on the committee that chose him, and I think we did a good job.
Well, you know, if you'd have about 15 more minutes, would you?
Sure, I'd
love to. Could you say what you think are about the 8 to 10 most important discoveries at UW since 1930, or is that would that be too? Is that not feasible?
Oh man, that's extremely difficult to them.
All right,
obviously,
two or three.
Obviously, Connie Alvium's discovery of nicotinamide as a vitamin is very important.
Important in terms of human health.
That essentially wiped out pellagra in the country, like Steenbach's discovery rickets.
Yeah, there'd be two kinds. One would be towards human health, and one would be towards the advancement of knowledge. DNA, for instance, would be the latter.
Yeah, so I mean, these... one can't judge them in quite the same terms. You see, you're always, as I tell the staff here, I happen to be a plant biochemist, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, people couldn't care less about plants. Virtually everyone that you run into is a mammalian chauvinist, as I tell them. If it doesn't happen to a mammal, forget it. It isn't worth considering. But you know, these people at the same time are absolutely dependent upon photosynthesis. If photosynthesis stops, the world stops, as far as biology is concerned. And I have the personal feeling plants are important.
All right,
but not very many people share that opinion. So my view of what's important on the campus might be a little bit different from somebody else.
Put in a word for your plants, then.
But I recognize at the same time that people are interested in health and issues such as this. And the great reputation of the biochem department was built in nutrition, very clearly. I mean, during the E.B. Hart era, it was a nutritional impact, and it was a very important impact. fat-soluble vitamins, water-soluble vitamins, right down the roll. They're very important contributions. Well, obviously, Gobin-Kronis stuff was absolutely outstanding. Gobin's work on synthesizing a gene, as they would say in the press, was an absolutely outstanding contribution in chemistry and in biology. Mm-hmm. And people now do this sort of thing rather routinely as the methods are developed. But at that time, it was a Herculean task. Mm. And Corona pulled it off in beautiful style. That was a very important development. In the area, if you want, in the area of plants, the outstanding contribution was Folke Skuggs' work on cytokinins.
Hmm.
These are very important compounds, and of course, this was collaborative with Frank Strong over here in terms of characterization, and one of Frank's Japanese students at the time. And Carlos Miller is in on that paper. He was a postdoc over with Skoog.
Hmm.
Yeah, he's at University of Indiana currently. So in the plant area, I would say the cytokinins stand out.
Well, that's enough, unless you have some more.
Well, that's only a couple,
but, I mean,
but you know, Howard Temin's stuff was done here, for which he got the Nobel Prize, and that's been very influential in the area of microbial genetics and genetics in general. I mean, it was sort of an unexpected twist that's been very important in the development, and this has been recognized by Nobel Prize. Of course, in the same era was when Josh Lederberg was here.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh's work on genetics and the sex-like combinations in bacteria and the transfer of genetic information and his replica plating technique were really very important in the formative years of genetics, molecular biology type of operation. And I'm proud to say that I was the one who first suggested to Josh that he use velvet for his replica plating technique.
Oh, really?
And I still have a chunk of the velvet here that I gave him a piece of. He came
nice.
Over and he said, "How am I going to make a replica plate here?" He says, "I get these petri dishes and I get growth, and I'd like to take those colonies and transfer to a new plate for replica plating for some of these things." And he said, "I've tried a variety of things and I don't get enough resolution." I said, "Why don't you try velvet? That's got lots of points."
What made you think of velvet?
It was just obvious, I guess. So I gave him a chunk of velvet that inherited from Tottingham. So the first replica plates were made with that. So that's my contribution, one and only contribution to genetics, is giving Josh a piece of velvet. So anyway, his work was very important. Certainly you can't neglect the impact of the dicumarol and warfarin story.
Mm-hmm.
And which was developed by Link and Stammen and Miyoshikawa.
Yeah. But that would be for its consequences more than for the actual work, is that right?
Well, the work was good too.
Yeah.
I mean, these things are usually based on careful science.
Yeah.
And that was true there. KP's science was good.
Yeah.
As was Mark's. No, it was good science. I mean, the development of preservation of sperm that is attributable to Paul Phillips and Henry Lardy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very important development in terms of the dairy industry, and of course led the way for lots of other applications and
but
such.
But from what Henry Lardy said, it happened. They discovered it very quickly. It was a question of just finding out what
was
so
a good
that
buffer.
It wasn't a difficult thing to find out. It was, but it was an important.
But
it was very
important. But scientifically, as far as the scientific work on it, you might almost say it was trivial in terms of the chemistry and such. They tried, they found that egg yolk buffer worked. It worked, so that's fine. My feeling is that the elegant science is the simple science.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't gain anything just by making it complicated. So it isn't necessary to apply a highly sophisticated piece of apparatus to come to the answer.
Oh, no.
If you can come to the answer by a simple way, it's that much better.
But there must be some discoveries that are more difficult to reach than others.
No, there's no question about that this is true. But the elegant science is frequently the simple science.
Well, then if you had to pick out the people from the 1930s on,
well, you know, I could go on this way. There are certain ones we've completely neglected. They're really very outstanding contributors in science and in teaching. People like Jim Crow and such, and Sewell Wright, and their contributions to population genetics. It's the sort of thing that the public doesn't appreciate, and I can't say that I appreciate it as much as I should either. But, you know, these are outstanding people. And Helmut Beinert in the Enzyme Institute, you know, he has brought the EPR techniques to the campus, and was sort of a pioneer in applying these in biological science. And very important contributions to enzymology have come through them.
All right, there's a little bit of time left on the tape. I'd like to find out. Do you go to the university club?
No.
You don't?
No.
Do you belong to a dining club?
No.
What do you do in your off time?
I go home and I read scientific journals. My wife would tell you. You mean hobbies and this sort of thing? No, I have certain interests. I've done a fair amount of canoeing up in Canada and that sort of thing. And I maintain a garden. And I've done photography for the last 50 years or so, and a few things like that.
Why don't you go to the university club? It's just too far away.
It's too far over there, and I can eat a sandwich here in my office for 15 minutes and read a journal the rest of the hour, and I never can keep up with scientific literature anyway, so why should I spend my time walking over there to talk to my colleagues? I never had any interest in the university club, really. I mean, I'm nothing against it, but I just isn't something that I'm interested in.
Some people think it's very important. It was, not now, but was for getting in touch with the rest of the campus.
That may be true, and it depends, I think, on the area. I keep in contact in other ways. For example, Winston Brill and Bakhti and I have run a journal club every Monday noon for years. And so his people from Bakhti and some of the people from agronomy and horticulture get together and we talk about...
Are these faculty or graduate students or both?
Faculty and graduate students, and we talk together about problems of mutual interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep in touch with my students with the Friday morning research conference every Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Every Friday noon we also have a journal club just of my group and Paul Ludden, who's next door. Paul was one of my students and he's now on the staff. So we keep in touch with these people and I see my colleagues in the hall and talk to them. I go fairly consistently to seminars and such in the department. There's a tremendous tendency to get isolated and narrow. So if one forces oneself to go to a number of seminars, you get a little bit of broadening. But
do most of your colleagues do that?
A lot of them go to seminars only when it's pretty directly in their area of interest.
Are these given by a graduate student give a paper, or is it a faculty?
Oh, well, we have graduate student seminars, and we attend those. But then
we
have a colloquium type of thing with outside speakers and such on diverse topics.
That's the one you're talking about.
Yeah, we also in the fall semester we have what is known as contemporary biochem, and this dates back quite some time. Phil Cohen and I dreamed it up on the plane back from Washington one time.
Is against contemporary trends, you mean?
We figured instead of having just a loose aggregate of speakers in the semester, why don't we take a central theme and get the speakers around a central theme for a whole semester and try to embrace not only biochemistry, but get in physiological chemistry, where Phil, of course, was the chairman, and genetics and bacteriology, and shift topics each semester.
And has it worked?
So I ran it for 16 years, and I think it was very successful because we got a clientele built up that would come because they knew every week that it was going to be at a particular time and it would be on a particular theme, and they got in the habit of coming. Now, when there is a diverse series of topics, they come and go and they forget about
it.
So I think it was very successful, actually. And the topic would change, and the committee would change each year with the topic.
Did faculty come too?
Oh yeah, we used to come around 150 people. The thing.
Goodness.
Between 100 and 150.
Is it still going on?
Yeah, I don't have anything to do with it anymore. It's passed over. But yeah, but I ran it for 16 years, and say if it was in an area where physiological chemistry was very interested, they'd have members on the committee, and we'd jointly get it. And the clientele for the thing would change with the topic.
Yeah.
But when they got there, they would come consistently. And I think it's been really a very successful series. Well, this is one of the things that we dreamed up on the plane one night. Phil and I thought we should carry it on. So it was always sort of centered here.
Yeah.